Hillsboro Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Ghosts of Tonkin on Saturday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m. This award-winning play dramatizes the behind-the-scenes story of how public officials brought about one of the most devastating chapters in the history of the United States, the Vietnam War, and of Oregon Senator Wayne Morse, one of only two congressmen to vote against the Tonkin Resolution. There will be a discussion following the play, moderated by KBOO's Joanne Hardesty, and includes playwright Steve Lyons and others. Again, that's The Ghosts of Tonkin, Saturday, September 27th at Lincoln Hall on the Portland State University campus, 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on The Ghosts of Tonkin can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, it's 9:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland. And coming right up, it's Veterans Voice with host Marvin Simmons on, and he's going to be talking about more on never-ending war. Also, a look back at the bonus soldiers who demanded payment for their service in World War I. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andres hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints featuring more on the escalating involvement of the U.S. war in Iraq with journalist Robert Perry. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, we speak with Barbara Quinn and Laura Feldman of Willamette Speaks about the Willamette Speaks storytelling event on Saturday, which seeks to gather community wisdom about the river and reconnect residents with the lower Willamette by sharing stories. And once again, thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one very easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says Donate Today. And here comes Veterans Voice with a little different theme this morning. Thanks for tuning in.
Come, you masters of war, here that build the big guns, here that build the death planes, here that build all the bombs, here that hide behind walls, here that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes, and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won, you want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire, and then you set back and whoa, when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be heard, fear to bring children into the world, for threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? But to talk out of turn, you must say that I'm young, You might say I'm unlearned, but there's one thing I know. I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find, when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon. I watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed, and I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
Point nine Hillsboro in Hood River and the Gorge, and 100.7 FM in Albany, Corvallis, and Eugene. Or you can hear us streaming on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. It's Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. You can hear some of our past shows by going to kboo.fm/veteransvoice. That's one word, Veterans Voice. And you can hear some of our past shows. I'm Marvin, and I'm here by myself with my great friend Tammy. So it's her and I against the world today. Mr. Bill's up at the VA hospital. He's not doing quite as, you know, as he should be. He should be going into rehab here in a couple days and getting better, so he can come back and be with us on the show. I really miss him, and he'll be back. And Angie's not here today. She had to be out of town, but she'll be back for the next show. And so I'm here to do it by myself, and Tammy's going to help me. And so I got a few things I want to do before we start the program. We're going to listen to the Bonus Soldiers March. And I think it's really interesting about what's going on now and the way they're treating veterans now and the way they treated them after the Great War to end all wars. And Columbia River Fellowship for Peace announces the completion and unveiling of the Wyeth Camp 21 Conscientious and Conservative Corps interpretive sign. It's going to be a ceremony of music, poetry, and sharing that Sunday, September 21st. That's International Day of Peace. And it's going to be at 3 p.m. at Wyeth Campground on Wyeth Road in Cascade Locks. It's exit 51. And you can, if you have questions about it, you live in that area, you want to go down, you can call Linda at 541-490-7287. And Linda's been a friend of ours for over 20-some years. And it's the Columbia River Fellowship for Peace, the completion and unveiling of the Wyeth Camp 21 interpretive sign. It should be very, very good. And also the forum, Peace and Justice Works, U.S. Foreign Policy, the wars continue as U.S. renews warfare in Iraq, remains in Afghanistan, supports the bombing of Gaza, and more. And that's Tuesday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Friends Meeting House at 4312 Southeast Stark here in Portland. And that would be a really good one to go to. Our brothers and sisters at Peace and Justice Works, Mr. Dan Handelman. And I thought this was pretty interesting. Naomi Klein, she has a new book out. It's This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. And she's going to be at Powell's Books out at Cedar Hills Crossing in Beaverton, and she's going to be there October 1st at 7 p.m. And that would be a really good one to go and see, to hear her talk, because she is so, so very interesting. And the stuff she says, you know, hits it right on the head, you know, shock and awe. Also, The Ghost of Tonkin, a play inspired by real events. And that's going to be Saturday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m. at Lincoln Hall at Portland State. And that's about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964 that really got us deeper into the war in Vietnam. And it turns out that it was all a big lie, that it was all set up, and it killed that lie. Killed over 3 million Vietnamese and killed 58,000 Americans and wounded who knows how many people that it wounded. And that's going to be Saturday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m. at Lincoln Performing Hall at Portland State University. And that should I'm going to go see that because, our own Wayne Morris was against that war. There was only two of them that voted against it, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. And Wayne Morris from here in Oregon was one of them that said no. And he was completely right about that war. Also, we got a message that, you know, our last show we had Sarah Bining on. She was the woman from Iraqi Veterans Against the War that had been AWOL from the military for 7 years, if I remember right. And we got a message that she got caught. And Angie, I think Angie's been in contact with her. Sarah can't take any phone calls, but Angie's been contacted her on the web, I believe, the internet. And so when Angie comes back, she'll tell us what's going on with Sarah. And boy, 7 years and get caught. That's really something. And also coming up October 1st through October 11th, our fall drive's coming up, and it's a good time for people to support our wonderful radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon, and keep us on the air, keep us going. We got a lot to say about stuff that you're not going to hear on the main airwaves, and KBOO's been going at it for a long time, and we're not done yet. KBOO's going to be needed more than ever with this continual war like Teresa and Ani and Lynn were talking about, this continuous war that they've got us into, you know. Bill and I have talked a lot about where's our peace dividend. Remember when the Soviet Union imploded, that we were going to get a peace dividend? Well, we haven't got that peace dividend, and I want to know where my share is. I want my share of that peace dividend, and we just don't seem to have it. And Lynn and Teresa and Ani talked about schools, please stock free military gear. You know, why in the world does the schools need all this M16s? They got armored vehicles, all this stuff. There's no reason for them to have. There's no reason for police forces to have them either. And it's just ridiculous that they have them. I don't know about Oregon, if Oregon has. I'm sure they do. I'm sure that they do have a lot of useless military stuff. Also, you know, you think about the military, you see all these pictures of these strong guys running around and being, you know, fighters and everything. But I just read it's overweight military, an increase in the number of overweight and out of shape service members unable to run long distances or unable to perform physical tasks like push-ups poses a direct threat to the U.S. ability to defend itself. So this whole little article here says that found that 12% of active duty service members are obese. It's up 61% since 2002. So there you go. Out of shape military. Out of shape military. I also I was listening to the radio the other day, and all of a sudden they came out talking about the U.S. are going to send 3,000 soldiers to Liberia under the pretext of the Ebola outbreak. And that, and I thought, I've heard this somewhere before. And I started thinking back, and that's how they got troops into Vietnam at one time, too. What they did, they were looking for a reason to get troops into South Vietnam. And so there was a flood in the Delta, down in the Mekong Delta in southern Vietnam. And so they sent all these troops down in that area. And that was their cover to get some troops into South Vietnam to build up their troops. And so why aren't they sending doctors? Why aren't they sending nurses? Why aren't they sending medical equipment and all of this to Liberia instead of sending combat troops? You know? And it's just another ploy. It's a continuation of this continual war. And people don't even blink an eye when they hear about it. They don't blink an eye. They hear troops are going to Liberia. They're going to fight Ebola. But, you know, that's just, you know, U.S. Africa Command is starting to be a pretty big thing. A lot of troops are going into Africa, and the U.S. has moved back into Asia. You know, they've got troops just everywhere now. It's just continual war, and Americans are just going to be spending more and more and more and more and more money, and getting less and less and less benefits to take care of ourselves, like single payer health care. We're not going to have it. More and more military. We're becoming more and more of a military dictatorship in this country. And somebody brought up to me, too, and this was really interesting, too. They brought up to me that this horrible, horrible decapitation of these people by the troops, the ISIS troops. But, you know, that's only part of the story. Every war that happens, every war, people decapitate people. It happened in World War One, it happened in World War Two, it happened in Vietnam. It all, for some reason, it's just something that happens. I was looking back. I remember pictures of it in Vietnam. There was like three or four American soldiers were sitting there, and they had decapitated two Viet Cong. And then I found another picture of 1930 in Nicaragua, where Marine was standing there, and they had decapitated a Sandinista. So it goes on in every war. And to use this as a pretext of sending troops in arms into fight ISIS is just a ploy. It's just a ploy. And when you hear about something like that happening, you know, that it happened in every war. Every war it happens. And they're using it just as for propaganda of getting the Americans riled up and getting them to, well, we got to send troops, you know. Everywhere in the world, we don't have to send troops everywhere in the world. We're just running out of, you know, excuses. Why don't they just come out and just say, well, we're the police of the world, and we're going to spend all of our money on the military. So we just, you know, we gotta fight back against that. We just cannot continue to let this happen. We can't continue to let this happen. And we were talking this morning, Tammy and I were talking a little bit, and I brought up about G.W. Bush, you know, and Dick Cheney and all these people. You know, they got us into this mess. They got us into this mess by attacking Iraq. And as soon as they attacked Iraq, this whole can of worms, blood, the blood bucket got opened, and all this killing in Iraq and in Syria and all around the world over this, George Bush and Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, they got away with it. Why aren't they in a cell in The Hague on war crimes? You know, I was looking back to find out about the war crime. We never signed the onto the war crimes tribunal. The U.S. never signed onto it. And the only the only ones that have been brought to trial at The Hague have been Africa, been people from Africa, leaders from Africa. So why not, you know, anybody else? Why isn't that being used to Francis Boyle? Professor Boyle was part of a trial in Kuala Lumpur that convicted George W. Bush and Dick Cheney on war crimes. And you never hear anything about that. Nothing. They just got away with it. They just got away with the slaughter and murder and killing of innocent people, and they just got away with it. And there's something bad wrong with that. I want to we're going to play a show we had played before, and it's about the bonus march of that happened in 1932. And the way I wanted to play that, because I wanted to, the way they're treating veterans now, you know, they came up about the trouble with the VA hospitals. You know, we've been complaining for years and years and years about the hospitals, and nothing ever happened. You know, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're doing stuff about it. And the way they treated, you know, the soldiers after World War One, after they're a little better after World War Two. Korea, they didn't even care too much about them. Vietnam, they didn't care about us. And they do a little bit of, you know, caring about our brothers and sisters coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. But the bonus march started right here in Portland, Oregon. And it was a it's a very interesting part of our history here in Portland. And I thought that we'd play it a little bit. And then I've got some, I have a book here. It's called The Horror of It All, Camera Records of War Gruesome Glories About World War II. I mean, World War One, after World War One, and there's some poems in it, a poem or two I want to read to you after we listen to this story. Yeah, it's about 26 minutes, the whole story. But about 3 minutes in, it jumps a little bit, so if you hear it jump a little bit, don't worry, it'll continue to go. It's called The Bonus March. Tammy, you want to go ahead and start that?
Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Barbara Bogave. In 1921, in the aftermath of World War I, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier was unveiled in Arlington Cemetery. Associated Press reporter Kirk LaRue Simpson filed this report about the ceremonies. Under the wide and starry skies of his own homeland, America's unknown dead from France sleeps tonight, a soldier home from the wars. Alone, he lies in the narrow cell of stone that guards his body, but his soul has entered into the spirit that is America. Wherever liberty is held close in men's hearts, the honor and the glory and the pledge of high endeavor poured out over this nameless one of fame will be told and sung by Americans for all time. America has never had a problem honoring its war dead. It's honoring the survivors of war that has proved a sticking point. You'd think it would be a no-brainer. Men go off to war, risk their lives and limbs for their country, and when they return, they deserve no less than their country's full gratitude, support, and recognition. Right? But how often has it worked out that way? Fact, 1/3 of all homeless in the U.S. are Vietnam vets. Then there's the Agent Orange and Gulf War Syndrome cover-ups, just to name a few shameful examples. True, veterans of the Second World War received extensive financial and educational benefits through the GI Bill, but that came about in large part because of a dark chapter in the history of the homecoming soldier. Back during the Depression, thousands of disgruntled World War I veterans requested that the government come through on a promise made years earlier to pay them a bonus, a bit of extra pay to get them back on their feet. They and their families camped out in Washington, D.C. and marched for their cause. What resulted was the greatest unrest our nation's capital has ever known. To mark this year's Memorial Holiday, producer Lex Gillespie tells the story of the Bonus Army March.
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.
In the 1930s, America was in the throes of the Great Depression. Some 10 million people, or about one quarter of the population, were unemployed. People stood in bread lines for food.
All I want's just food for my baby. Give to me my old job back.
I lost my job in the cannery in December 1930, and our savings and the hope of work vanished soon after.
Walter Waters was an unemployed World War I veteran in Portland, Oregon.
Our personal belongings found their way to pawn shops, and we were left with nothing but a scanty wardrobe. I found family after family in the same condition or worse. I saw men half-clad in threadbare clothing pacing the streets in soleless shoes.
Waters led the Bonus Army of impoverished veterans that marched on Washington. This reading, by an actor, is adapted from Waters' 1933 book on the events.
There were more than 1,800 unemployed veterans in Portland who had families, in addition to those who stood alone in bread lines. These men talked a great deal about the so-called bonus, a payment to compensate men for service in the military. The majority of the veterans hoped it would pass.
The veterans wanted the immediate payment of a bonus the U.S. government had promised them. Their push for compensation began soon after the armistice was signed.
Our fathers fought the First World War to make the world safe for democracy, for the common man. They fought a good fight and won it.
Victorious soldiers, fresh from the trenches of Europe, marched in flag-waving street parades. But after returning to the States, the veterans received only nominal post-war compensation for their military service. Historian Michael Bennett.
This had started because the World War I veteran had been welcomed back in New York and given $60 and a one-way ticket home.
Back then, there was no GI Bill. But to help veterans make the transition to civilian life, the U.S. Congress passed a bonus bill. Yet it promised vets only a future payment. Their compensation wasn't scheduled to be paid until 1945, some 20 years later.
The 1924 bonus bill was not, properly speaking, a bonus bill. It was designed to make up the difference between what these guys would have received at the average factory wage had they remained at home and what they received in the military. So it wasn't an attempt to give them a pension or anything like that. It was a one-shot deal. They didn't give them the money all at one time. They said, okay, we're going to give you a small amount of money on account, and it will build up with compound interest over 20 years' time, and then it will become $1,000. So they were getting the payment on a savings bond, if you will.
But with the stock market crash and the hard times of the Depression setting in, the vets didn't want to wait until 1945 to receive their bonus.
Well, they figured the government had called them to duty, and it was up to the government to help them. Yeah, that's simple.
James Dunton is a veteran of World War I, where he served with the ambulance corps.
Here, these people all served in the armed forces. Most of them had been overseas. They were veterans, and that's no way to treat people that have served their country. And that was the way that people, the average American, looked at it.
In Oregon, Walter Waters helped assemble a loose ragtag collection of a few hundred ex-soldiers. They got together to petition Congress and President Herbert Hoover for a quick payment of the bonus. In May 1932, with hearts full of hope, the Bonus Army set out for Washington. Waters recalls how many hopped freight trains and headed east.
Riding the rails, the men would get together and saying, We're all the way from Oregon to get some cash from Washington. Hinky dinky parlez-vous. You're gonna see a better day when Mr. Hoover says okay. Hinky dinky parlez-vous.
Meanwhile, news of the approaching army spread fear in the nation's capital.
The administration of Washington at that time and the federal government, they didn't know what to expect. My God, it would be, as a kid I had read about revolution, but I didn't believe that anything like this could happen.
Washington native Fred Blacker, now 84 years old, was a teenager in 1932. He recalls how a D.C. policeman came to his father's shoe store and warned of possible trouble.
The police had come around when they started to come in and told us, or told my parents, or my mom was there, don't wear jewelry, don't give too much if they come in for money, be very careful. In other words, they were making a big bunch of criminals coming into the city, which they were not. They were just poor, poor, penniless veterans who had fought for our country.
When the Portland Bonus Army arrived, it was a rock that started a landslide.
Again, Walter Waters.
On June 7th, to the beat of a solitary drummer, the parade that moved down Pennsylvania Avenue showed to what distance our movement had reached. In silent ranks, the Oregon group marched with coal miners from Pennsylvania and cotton pickers from Alabama. Men from New York flop houses walked beside fruit pickers from Miami. There were Tennessee mountaineers and even one lighthouse keeper from South Carolina. It was a picture of honest men in poverty. Mr. Hoover said there were no hungry men in America. Either he was wrong or these men imagined their hunger. One sign read, "Goats can eat paper and rags. We can't."
At first, the Bonus Army was given 48 hours to leave. But the vets found an ally in Pelham Glassford, D.C.'s police superintendent, who had been a World War I general. As many as 20,000 Bonus marchers came to Washington, making it the biggest rally of its kind to date in the nation's capital. Historian Michael Bennett.
There had been a march on Washington in 1893, Coxey's March, so-called, during a very severe depression. Men started from Ohio to Washington, but President Cleveland intervened and had them thrown off the trains before they actually arrived in Washington.
And unlike other demonstrations, the Bonus Army occupied Washington for 2 months. Some veterans squatted in abandoned buildings on Pennsylvania Avenue, near what is today Federal Triangle. And in Anacostia, in an area called the Flats, Walter Waters recalls how they built a huge makeshift army camp, complete with a bugle player.
The Anacostia Flats looked like a cross between a Congo village, a trash pile, a picnic ground, and a tourist camp. Living there were 10,000 penniless veterans and many families. There were 700 wives and 300 children. They washed and bathed in the river. For shelter, they took anything that could be put upright. Hovels were made of cardboard or packing boxes. Dismantled automobile bodies were salvaged from junk heaps. There were ancient double-decker bed frames with boards stretched across them and bags of dried grass used for mattresses. All this kept sleeping families out of the mud.
The living conditions were horrible. Now, the people, you looked at them, they were wretched looking. The women were haggard. The kids, oh my God, they were lucky to eat.
Fred Blacker visited the camps of Bonus marchers.
Some of them were shaved, some were unshaven. They boiled water in pots. Sometimes it was old tin cans that the potato chips came in to have hot water. They had to bring in water. I think, if I remember, the Army did bring in water trucks for them. But the government, to my knowledge, it never gave them food. It wasn't nice. I keep saying that because it's been an imprint in my mind.
The veterans depended upon donations for their meals. Evelyn Walsh McLean, a rich Washington socialite, once bought 1,000 sandwiches for them. Other D.C. residents also helped the marchers. Some even opened their homes to them.
My father did. I don't even know if he told my mother until he brought him back to the house.
Fran Wortlieb was 11 years old when her father invited a Bonus marcher, his wife, and two children to stay in their modest Washington home.
I don't know how I got hooked up with his family, but they were a Jewish family from New York, and I guess he had some sympathy for him and took him to the house. It was very bad living there, especially when it rained. A mess. Mud. he wanted to treat them nice, which we all did. I'm sure they were really happy when my father said they could come home with us. And that changed their picture.
But the sight of this huge shanty town in the nation's capital made other people fearful. Some worried about disease spreading from the veterans' Anacostia camp, and there were other fears as well. John DeJoseph covered the Bonus March as a photographer for the New York Times.
My assignment was every morning to go to the Anacostia Flats where they were bivouacked. And when I got up there, I was amazed. They were loaded with guns and so forth. I said, this is not good. So I told my office. I didn't take any pictures of them with the guns. And my office alerted Colonel Starring at the White House that these guys meant trouble.
The veterans said they carried rifles and pistols to maintain order within their huge camp. But rumors spread of an armed insurrection.
1932 finds the American democracy on the verge of deep panic. In Washington, there are demonstrations in front of the Capitol itself. Jobless veterans petitioning Congress for quick payment of the bonus set for 1945.
The country was very frightened. The country was very scared.
Historian Michael Bennett says the Great Depression heightened fears of a government overthrow. Some bonus marchers were even branded as communists plotting a revolution.
Don't forget, the level of desperation was enormous. There wasn't any social safety net. I mean, imagine, we had an unemployment rate of 20-25%. Times were very, very desperate.
Some critics accused the veterans of being beggars, merely looking for a government handout. President Herbert Hoover, who sought re-election in 1932, opposed the bonus. Hoover said the government should play a limited role in helping its citizens, and he praised the free market in many of his speeches.
Now, my conception of America is a land where men and women may walk in ordered liberty, where they may enjoy the advantages of wealth, not concentrated in the hands of a few, but diffused through opportunity to all, where they may build and safeguard their homes, give to their children the full opportunities of American life.
Several veterans, wearing their old olive drab uniforms, tried to meet with President Hoover at the White House.
As one veteran said to me, we're going come hell or high water.
Photographer John DeJoseph.
A couple of the guys jumped the fence, but didn't do them any good.
The fence jumpers were arrested, and President Hoover refused a meeting with any of the other bonus marchers. But they did win support from lawmakers on Capitol Hill.
Another unknown speaker.
May I remind our president, with all due respect, that not one of these soldiers cast a ballot on that fateful Good Friday night in the spring of 1917 to force a peace-loving nation like ours to take up arms for the profiteers and the exploiters of mankind.
I am demanding that this just debt be paid in full and at once. I contend that the fair and just treatment of our soldiers is our best national insurance.
These 3 million soldiers, their wives and their children, had already figured just what each of them would do with the few hundred dollars that each one of them were to get. No doubt each of them had calculated to pay some debts, to buy some food and to buy some clothes and maybe to send a boy or girl to school.
Congressman Wright Patman, a Democrat from Texas, championed the soldiers' cause. He introduced legislation to speed payment of their bonus. But federal and local officials tried to thwart the vets' effort to garner support in Congress. Photographer John DeJoseph.
Wright Patman wanted to have this rally on the east front of the Capitol, have the different congressmen talk to these veterans. So that morning, Major Glassford, who was police chief, raised the 11th Street Bridge so they couldn't cross it. So Wright Patman called him up and raised Kane. Lower the bridge. They only want to go to the Capitol to talk to the congressman. Well, they lowered the bridge, and they got up there at the Capitol Plaza.
In June 1932, the House of Representatives passed the bonus bill by 33 votes. But opposition in the Senate was stronger. A senator asked, "Why should we give a benefit to one segment of the nation and not to another?" Walter Waters and fellow vets awaited the crucial Senate vote.
Outside the Capitol were 8,000 men sitting on the steps, the lawns, the curbstones. The senators were experiencing a new kind of lobbying, not that of being entertained in some swank hotel with a business at hand, as nonchalantly mentioned after a few drinks, but that of being shown something of the poverty that had prompted the demand for the bonus payment. Suddenly, someone from inside came to get me, and I returned with some bad news. I climbed on a pedestal at the Capitol steps to address the crowd. "Prepare yourselves for disappointment, men. The bonus has been defeated, 62-18. Wait, wait, this is only a temporary setback. We are going to get more and more men, and we are going to stay here until we change the minds of those guys. You're 10 times better Americans than the senators that voted against the bill." But a silence set in that was unbroken, electric. 8,000 men might storm the building in the next few minutes. I didn't know what would happen next.
The Senate defeat threw the bonus army into disarray. Dejected, many veterans returned home. And with the upcoming 1932 elections, there was pressure to move them all out. The D.C. government ordered the eviction of the squatters from Pennsylvania Avenue. On July 28th, events came to a head.
I observed, while I was there, army trucks heading west to east. And I thought it was a parade, because only parades in those days were on Pennsylvania Avenue. That was our parade avenue, which really most of it still is.
Fred Blacker was waiting to catch a streetcar on Pennsylvania Avenue when the eviction began.
And these trucks went by, and I saw soldiers in there, and I saw some mounted machine guns on the tail, and I was a kid then. What did I know about the Army? And I asked a gentleman staying there, I said, "Do you know what's going on? What kind of parade? What holiday is this?" He says, "It's no parade, bud." He says, "It's just a bunch of soldiers that have been ordered to come out to clean out the bonus armies." I says, "What, clean out these poor men who have fought for us?"
It's war. The greatest concentration of fighting troops in Washington since 1865. All assembled with a single purpose: to rout the bonus army from government property which they have been occupying without permission.
Earlier that day, July 28th, as this Universal Newsreel reports, an altercation with D.C. police took place. Details are sketchy. One or two bonus marchers were shot dead. Historian Michael Bennett.
The word of the disturbance went very quickly from Lower Pennsylvania Avenue, about where Federal Triangle is, over to the White House. Hoover ordered that an effort be made to disperse the bonus marchers from that immediate area surrounding the White House.
Walter Waters.
At 4 o'clock, the military column moved down Pennsylvania Avenue. In full uniform, General Douglas MacArthur, the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, led the way. The column moved against Americans who were not only capped under the American flag, but who had served under it.
Well, when they reached 7th and Pennsylvania Avenue, and these veterans saw MacArthur on the horse and all these tanks, well, they didn't like it.
Photographer John D. Joseph covered the events for the New York Times.
So a shot was fired. Now that shot that was fired was tear gas. And that started the commotion, everything.
It's a spectacle unparalleled in the history of the country. A day of bloodshed and riot, reminiscent of actual conditions in France in 17. Sullen, disgruntled, the veterans give way unwillingly before the steady advance of the soldiers. The tension is terrific. Real drama of the highest rank. But the orders of the President and Secretary of War must be obeyed.
Some of the veterans were on top of a building on the corner there of 7th and the Avenue. The veterans on top of the building throwing bricks down at the police. And oh, it was a mess. It was just so much noise and confusion, hollering. And they started to scatter out all these makeshift shanties that were there, the families screaming and carrying on. And I got down in there and I stayed around and saw all this havoc going on. Believe me, my friend, it was terrible.
The soldiers marched along the avenue while ex-servicemen stood in bewildered silence. They stopped the buildings and took them one at a time. The men were chased out with drawn bayonets and gas bombs.
Gradually, the Bonus Army realizes that they'd better be good, and a general retreat begins, interrupted here and there by a stubborn veteran. But resistance isn't practical. They soon find out that it doesn't pay to monkey with a buzzsaw, and there's an occasional free ride to jail or hospital.
The troops reached Anacostia about 11 that night. Bedlam broke loose. I watched silently the events of the night, hurrying from camp to camp. The soldiers arrived with tear gas and bayonets. One child was in his father's arms when a soldier tossed a gas bomb, but his father couldn't run fast enough, and the baby died a few days later in a hospital. The troops set fire to the shacks on the edge of the camp. The jeers and cries of the evicted men and women rose above the crackling of the flames. The fires lit up the night sky.
And the roaring flames sound the death knell to the fantastic Bonus Army. Many have gone back home, betrayed by unscrupulous leaders. Some still sincere in the adventure that failed, and that ends so disastrously in the shadow of the beautiful dome of the Capitol of the United States of America.
After 2 months of occupying the nation's capital, the Bonus Marchers straggled home, empty-handed.
That is called the Bonus Soldiers, the Bonus March in Washington, D.C. in 1932. It just shows you what the government thinks about its population when they can turn on veterans and kill veterans and the children of veterans, and just this whole thing, you know, that if you, people don't think that the military will turn its guns on us. Look what they did to Kent State. Look what they did at Jackson State. They turned their guns on them, and now they're militarizing the police department, and you've seen what that's happened, the killing of the young black men all across this country by militarized police departments. They're sending our troops all around the world. They're bombing the people in Iraq and Syria. You know, those bombs don't just kill soldiers. They kill everything. They kill animals. They kill civilians. They destroy stuff, the land, the buildings, everything, you know. American people don't know what war is, you know, the horror, the devastation of war, the maiming and the killing and the violence of war. And, you know, they make it look so sanitary. You know, we're going to bomb this, we're going to bomb that. Those bombs, they have no conscience. The bombs have no conscience. Angie just called while this story was playing. And with a sad story, an Iraqi veteran against the war, a young man, Jacob David George, has committed suicide. He did a bicycle tour across America for peace, and he took his life. And tonight at 5 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, there's going to be a vigil for this young man. And veterans, 22 veterans a day are killing themselves. You know, you think, being a veteran, I know, you know, we fight demons every day. Every day we fight demons that from the wars. And this young man, the demons got the best of him. So tonight at 5 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, they're going to be a vigil for this young man who took his own life. So I hope people can go down there and talk and be with this young man, with the other veterans down there tonight at 5 p.m. 22 veterans a day. 22 veterans a day. I have this book I was talking to you about earlier. It's called The Horror of It. This is Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And it's called The Horror of It. Records of War's Gruesome Glory. And it was made in 1932. And they had a whole battle with the federal government to get these pictures. They did not want to release these pictures that is in this book. These just horrible, horrible, horrible pictures. It shows the wounded, different different pictures of guys who were wounded, what they look like and what happened to them. They have pictures and battles. They have just pictures you're never going to ever see. And I can see why they didn't want to release these pictures. But the book has some really good good poems in it. And years ago, we had students from Lincoln High School come to the show, and we said, get a poem, get a poem from the Revolutionary War, get one from World War One, World War Two, Vietnam, whatever you want, get a poem and come on the show and read it. And they came on the show and they read these poems, and they were just amazing, these kids. But one kid said, well, I didn't get a poem. He says, I made a rap poem, a rap song, and he did this wonderful anti-war rap song, and it was just really amazing. But this one poem, this is a one poem, it's from The Other Side and Other Poems by Captain Gilbert Frankau. It's War, a dirty, loathsome, servile murder job. Men lousy, sleepless, ulcerous, afraid. Men stunned to brainlessness and gibbering. Men maimed and blind. Men against machines. Flesh versus iron, concrete, flame and wire. Men choking out their souls in poison gas. Men squelched into the slime by tramping feet. Dead bodies used to build a trench again. Men disemboweled by guns 5 miles away. Cursing with their last breath the living God because he made them in his image. Poems came out of World War One that were just so, so anti-war, anti-violence, just unbelievable. Here's another one by James Norman Hall. Could you have seen them marching, 10,000 men in line? You would have said that the war must be adventurous and fine. You would have felt your pulse beat fast to the tread of marching feet. But had you seen them creeping back in the gray, gray dawn, the broken, bleeding bodies with all their beauty gone, oh, never could you cheer again to see 10,000 fighting men. And there's some more in here. This whole thing, this continuous war that they've got us into, the taking of our children, just the taking of and the killing and the maiming and the waste of money and resources for these people, that they're doing. And in Vietnam, they're still suffering in Vietnam from the war that we did against the people of Vietnam. Every year, people are stepping on old landmines that we left there years and years and years and years ago, killing children, killing farmers, killing animals, and this continues to go on. Iraq, Afghanistan, just a continuous bloody, bloody, bloody war. I'm going to read one more. The Inexcusable Lie by Harold R. Peat. If a war started tomorrow, would we of 1914 be as enthusiastic in going again? I know we wouldn't be. We couldn't be. It isn't the danger. It isn't that war is lacking in adventure, but because we now know that it isn't glorious. We were told in school it was. We know now that for every Victoria Cross won, there must be 10,000 wooden crosses won. We were not told so much about the wooden crosses at school. We know that men excel themselves in war, but now we also know that to excel is to kill. In 1914, we saw and knew statues of heroes of our glorious tradition, but now as fathers of our boys, we, super patriots of 1914, pray our government of England, France, Germany, Russia, America, and humanity that our sons be told and taught the truth of war. A little more of the wooden crosses and a little less of the glory cross. Teach them young so that as statesmen they may know that war is too filthy a way for civilized men to settle their differences. Just heartbreaking, some of these stories. Well, here's another one. 12,000 corpses were encumbering this river, among which were thousands of women and children. Navigating was all but impossible. Every moment the boat had to plow her way through a tangled, mangled mass of corpses strung and lashed together by their long hair. The river banks were literally covered with them, and in the curves of the winding stream were to be seen dark, putrid masses of human flesh and bones surging and swaying in the streamers awake in wars. That's from Wars Helly's Panorama. And so I think we'll be back on October 17th at 9 a.m. This is Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. We're going to go out with Brothers in Arms by Mark Knopfler, and we'll see you next month at 9 a.m., and there it is.
Mist-covered mountains are home now for me, but my home is the lowlands, and always will be. Someday you'll return to your valleys and your farms, and you'll no longer burn to be brothers in arms. These fields of destruction, baptisms of fire, I've witnessed your suffering as the battle reached high. And in the fear and the alarm, you did not desert me, my brothers and I. There's so many different worlds.
indicator of mass injustice in a society. BPs are those in every land, throughout every era, who were imprisoned for fighting mass injustice. It is no different today regarding mass incarceration of BPs in the U.S. They must be freed.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Poetic Hip Hop Day of Action for former Black Panther and political prisoner Soon Diata Akoli on Monday, September 22nd at Anjoni Restaurant in Portland. There will be a writing workshop from 5 to 6 p.m. and a poetry reading open mic from 7 to 8:30 p.m. based on Soon Diata's writing prompt. Featured speakers include Rochelle Radizi Hart, Black Butterfly, Walida Imarisha, Ajamu Umi, and more. Again, that's the Portland Poetic Hip Hop Day of Action for Soon Diata Akoli on Monday, September 22nd at Anjoni Restaurant, 910 North Killingsworth Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the PDX People's Climate March on Sunday, September 21st. Gathering will begin at 3 p.m. at the Park Bowl of Tomacole Waterfront, just south of the Hawthorne Bridge. World leaders are gathering in New York City for a UN summit on climate change, and across the country, people will be out in the streets to demand a better world for ourselves and for generations to come. Again, that's the People's Climate March on Sunday, September 21st.